From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. President-elect Barack Obama has promised to make health care reform one of his priorities. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about some of the tough choices he'll face regarding health insurance, embryonic stem cell research, and the public health system. We'll talk with Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Last month, Discover magazine named Kaplan one of the 10 most influential people in science. We'll also talk about the face transplant just performed at the Cleveland Clinic and the new ethical questions it raises. Also, our book critic Maureen Corrigan will be here with her list of the best books of 2008. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Health insurance, stem cell research, problems at the VA hospitals, a weak public health system. These are just some of the healthcare-related issues facing President-elect Barack Obama. We asked bioethicist Art Kaplan to take a look at some of the tough choices Obama will have to make. Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics and chairs the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Last month, Discover magazine named him one of the 10 most influential people in science. The entry said, quote, "Kaplan has sorted through the ethical traps of science for the United Nations, the National Institutes of Health, the President of the United States, and the Olympics, and has written or edited more than 30 books and 500 articles," unquote. A little later, we'll talk with Kaplan about yesterday's announcement from the Cleveland Clinic that doctors there had just performed the first face transplant in America and some of the important ethical questions that raises. Art Kaplan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with health insurance. A lot of people have lost their jobs this year, and most of those people lost their health insurance too because their health insurance was tied to their jobs. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's really terrible for the individuals who've lost their health insurance, but it's pretty bad for us as a culture too. What are some of the kind of larger problems that individuals losing their health insurance in this recession are creating for us as a society?
Well, they really do create big problems for all of us. It's not the case that if someone's laid off from one of the automobile companies or loses their job at a media organization, that's just sad, but it's a matter of indifference for me and my health insurance. For one thing, those people still need health care. So they're still going to have babies. They're still going to get sick. They're still going to get in accidents. That means crowded emergency rooms. You know, there's no right to health care currently in the United States. There is, however, a right to emergency health care. So you can go to an ER still, and their duty or obligation by law is to stabilize you. Well, that's where a lot of people go who lose their health insurance. They wind up sitting in the ER. That means it's crowded. That means a lot of that care is going to get paid for by charity or bad debt or state funds. As we know, the states are not doing well fiscally these days. They're all California, Pennsylvania. They're all running billions and billions of dollars of deficit that builds and adds on to that deficit. When these people lose their health insurance, their children lose their health insurance. You don't go to the dentist. You put off the eye exam. It can affect everything from school performance all the way out to, is a child with a mental illness going to do harm to themselves or others because they can't get any type of care? When people lose their jobs, there's an odd impact, a very strange one. It's almost something we don't think about. But the people in the workforce are relatively healthy. When they're losing their insurance, they're winding up leaving behind, if you will, a lot of people with big medical needs, but they're not in there putting their money into the system anymore. So the price of what goes on all of a sudden is raised because you're taking out, in a sense, the healthiest folks. And now who's out there who has needs? Medicaid, Medicare, but there's no one to bootstrap or cost shift to because the private insurance pool is shrinking because they're losing their jobs. So it's big.
So what message do you think that the recession is sending about employer-sponsored health care?
I think the message is pretty clear. Employer-sponsored health care doesn't make any sense. It never has made any sense. Getting your health insurance through your job is a system that is a historical accident of the United States. No one else does it that way. If we went to Germany or Taiwan or England, they all have different healthcare systems, but none of them say if you work, then you get healthcare as a benefit, if you will, of being a worker. Historically, health insurance got tied to jobs because unions were looking for ways to attract members. You know, back in the sort of beginning of the 20th century, they had all these different ethnic groups. People didn't get along. The unions weren't sure they could organize and grow. So they offered health insurance as a perk. That's how it got connected up initially to work. The AMA, early 20th century, the American Medical Association, didn't like worker-based health insurance. They wanted universal health care insurance. They were sort of on the left of this issue. But it all changed because of the linkage initially through unions, and then it became a kind of condition in our society that you got health insurance because you earned it, you worked for it. to me, morally, it doesn't make sense to say you have to earn your health insurance. If you're sick, you're going to need health insurance, and either we're going to leave you out in the street or we're going to do something about it. So this notion of deservingness isn't, I think, correct to connect to health insurance. And then literally just attaching it to your employment, that means that Ford Motor and United Widget and Bananas of America all have to hire people to sort out your health insurance. What do they know about it, or why should we presume that they're any good at it? It's a hugely expensive overhead cost for business. It's not something that businesses in industries outside of healthcare have any particular expertise at. Why do it?
So President-elect Obama is going to be coming into the White House at a time when so many people have lost their jobs and health insurance too. Is the health care plan that he proposed going to deal with that aspect of health care, the fact that so many people are unemployed now?
Well, he's trying to make it possible for smaller businesses to purchase health care more cheaply. He will try to make it possible for people to join up health plans like the one that the federal government runs for federal employees. So he wants to, in a sense, open eligibility to that plan. He isn't taking the most radical option, which is to disconnect health insurance from employment. That isn't proposed. He's still got it pretty tightly tied to businesses and trying to make it affordable. He also isn't taking a step that I think some people feared, which is to nationalize healthcare. We're not going to see single payer, meaning the government setting the rates and kind of handling the paperwork. That isn't part of his system either. It's opening the door to the federal system to more people and trying to encourage, through financial support, small business possibilities to pay for health insurance. So I think it'll help. Probably not going to get us to 100% universal coverage, though.
So under Obama's plan, what would it take to sign up with this federal health insurance plan?
Basically, you'd come along and say, I pick this federal health insurance plan over the one my employer's offering because I think it's cheaper for me to go over there, and you'd be allowed to do it. Or you might be in a situation where you just lost your job and said, I had no place to go, but out of my own pocket, I'm going to spend $4,000 or $6,000 and try to get to the federal plan. Now, clearly, people who are unemployed are going to need some help, tax subsidy or some kind of assistance to pay for some of these costs. But I think the idea is don't make it free, but make it affordable by subsidy for those who are unemployed. And I should add, underemployed. The other big group of us Americans who wander around the healthcare system are the 22-year-olds flipping burgers in McDonald's or the person who's an aspiring actress on Broadway. None of those people have health insurance now either. Parents know this very well. They come off your health plan at the end of college, and all of a sudden we've got this big bolus of people either working part-time or in jobs that don't offer health care or that just don't worry about it because they're self-employed or students but too old to qualify for benefits. So that's millions and millions of Americans there, too, who he'd try to pull in through this federal option.
Is the federal option any cheaper than just going out and buying health insurance on your own?
It would be because for a couple of reasons. The pool of people is big. So I think there are currently 10 million people in the federal plan. So that gives you a lot of purchasing power. Mm-hmm. I think the federal government is willing to negotiate prices as a group a little bit more than some of the private insurance companies do. So that should drive costs down. It is a system that gets a little bit better drug prices because it bargains and lowers the cost there. And I think the federal plan tries to control costs a little bit by directing you toward doctors and hospitals and clinics that they prefer and then charging you more for choice. So in a sense, you're paying more than you might be if you bought a full-bore private plan that said you can see anybody you want at any time, but you're going to pay through the nose for that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Art Kaplan. He's the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about some of the health issues that we'll be facing Barack Obama when he gets into the White House in January. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Art Kaplan. He's a professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also directs the Center for Bioethics. We're talking about some of the issues, the health-related issues, that will be facing Barack Obama when he becomes President Obama. If Obama's health care plan does go through and he makes some or most of the changes he wants to make, are there new funding issues that we're going to face about what interventions get funded and which ones are considered too high-priced or too unproven to be compensated for?
Well, most politicians, and I don't think Obama is an exception to this, don't really want to face up to the fact that medicine...
Oh, I see the word rationing coming.
You do.
Word everybody
hates.
It's
lurking over the horizon, but... You know, you have to go and make a confrontation with this reality at some point, and I think the day is here. Medicine continues to create new things. They're wondrous things, better drugs, better transplants, better medical devices. The cost is significant, and we have an aging society. They use more healthcare, and we use it more in an aging society. I think at some point in time, we're going to have to come to terms sometime in the next 8 years, if he goes into a second term, with rationing. We're going to have to finally bite the bullet and say, are there any limits? Are we going to limit by age? Are we going to limit by some notion of effectiveness? If it doesn't get to a certain level, then that's it. We're not paying. Are we going to say the rich can get things that the poor can't get? Not that that doesn't happen to some extent now, but are we going to sort of admit to it and almost make it policy? I don't see any way out of a confrontation with rationing in an Obama administration if we're really going to contain cost.
Where do you think he should start?
Drug prices are out of control. It makes no sense at all. To Americans, we're spending double what the rest of the world does. The rest of the world engages in negotiations with the drug companies and gets the best price. France, Singapore, England, wherever. The government sits down with the drug companies and says, this is what we're going to pay for. The drug company says, that's not enough. This is what you'll get. And they bargain to an end. Our friends in Canada do much the same. We have prices set by what the free market will bear, depending on who the payer is and depending on where you live. We all know about this because that's why people are running up to Canada to try and buy drugs or running down to Mexico or Costa Rica to try and get drugs, at least Americans are. The drug companies will tell you flat out, and we know these rates are unfair, but if we didn't have the Americans subsidizing these costs, then medical research would suffer. Well, okay, but why should Americans bear the cost of medical research for the rest of the planet? It makes no sense at all. You've got to get drug prices under control. This is a little inside baseball comment, but even to have Medicare Part D, the new benefit for elderly for drug coverage, the thing that people worry about with the donut hole, Congress explicitly forbid Medicare from negotiating the drug prices. Well, somewhere in that Obama administration, you've got to say, we're flipping that. We are going to negotiate. The drugs that you get in the VA or Department of Defense, half the price of what you'd buy at your drugstore. It's all negotiation of price.
I mean, it's already that way?
It's already that way. They're getting great rates on the government end, if you will. We've got to extend that through the system. So I think the fight right over drugs, pricing, bargaining, maybe sometimes saying we're not going to get the newest thing. Maybe we're going to get the generic first before we get to the prescription. But you can't have these exploding drug costs. And they're getting worse every year.
Now, Tom Daschle is Obama's choice for a new office, the White House Office of Health Reform, to direct that. And also he's Obama's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services. What's Tom Daschle's track record in terms of medical issues?
He's been very, very thoughtful on medical issues. The first thing that needs to be said is, and I think it's important to keep this in mind, you know, we failed to get health reform in America, meaning we haven't got universal coverage or universal access, I guess, since Roosevelt began talking about this. I mean, it's been talked about for a long, long time. Daschle is aware that the key breakthrough on this actually isn't economists and it isn't doctors. It's ethics. That is to say, you have to make a moral commitment to say there is a right to health care. Then we can start to argue about, well, how do we implement that and who should pay for it and what's the best system and so on. If you don't get consensus on that point, and if you look at the book he had out, the name of which is escaping me, but that he has a book out on health care, you see that he understands very well that you have to talk right to health care to drive forward health reform, to get universal access. But Obama does too.
Let me just back up and say you're a bioethicist, so you probably heartily concur with that premise that health care is an ethical issue.
Health care is an ethical issue. I think you have to drive the ethics point home, get Americans to agree, and then conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, their feet can be held to the fire about how to implement it. If you don't agree that it's a right, then I think there's a lot of room to wiggle away and say, you know, I'm sorry that 40 million people don't have it, but they don't have a right to it. I'm not sure my argument is the same as Daschle's. Daschle seems to think it's a right because it's something that, in a sense, Americans deserve. I might argue that it's a part of our commitment to equal opportunity. You can't compete. You can't be in a capitalist society if you don't have health. And to me, especially for children, mentally ill, people who can't navigate the system, they have no opportunity ability unless you give them health care. So it's, to me, it goes back to an opportunity basis more than anything else about the right. But be that as it may, Daschle gets that. He's committed to implementing that vision. And then I think he also understands it isn't prudent to set out and drastically change the trillions of dollar healthcare system that we have in a radical way. You've got to move it slowly. That was probably the lesson of Clinton. Mm-hmm. He paid attention to that Clinton healthcare reform. And you wind up saying, you know, you're sailing an aircraft carrier. It takes a long time to steer it in the direction that you want to go. So I think you're going to see some of the, let's reform the system we have. Let's try to build upon access through employment to extend it out to the small businesses. Modifying the system to include most of us is what really fuels the Daschle vision.
One of the things Daschle said he wants to initiate is a federal health board that would be an independent entity, kind of like the Federal Reserve is. What would this board do?
I am very, very enthusiastic about this notion of creating this board. I think it's about four decades overdue. If you think about what the FDA does now relative to healthcare, the FDA tries to regulate safety and it tries to establish efficacy. But what the FDA does not do and cannot do by law is compare treatment A to treatment B. So just to make this concrete, if there are 10 sleeping medicines out on the market and I come up with number 11 and my medicine isn't better than the other 10, but it does have some effectiveness, I can get it approved and try to sell it. In other words, I can sell an inferior product. If I get my advertising right, maybe I can fool you into buying it. This board would come out and say, look, we have to do comparative evaluation of what's out there. It needs to be independent. We can't rely on the drug company or the device manufacturer or some hospital to tell us what they do well. We've got to start the process of weighting and comparing and then using that to guide coverage. I'm all for that. It would give us data for the first time that would be useful to see what's better than something else. And it would put us in a position to start to say, you know, drug company, device company, whoever you are as a healthcare provider, what we want to see is not just things that work, but we want to make sure they work better than what we already have. And that's a guarantee we don't have right now in the system.
Is there anything else this board would do?
Board would probably try to understand prices. And that's a little bit of that Federal Reserve notion. I don't know how many listeners have had the joy of pulling out their bill from a hospital. So you look and see things that are mysterious, such as aspirin, $37. You think to yourself, gee, I know they're expensive, but if I go down to the drugstore, I think I can beat that price. Why that much? Well, pricing at the hospital end is all done by cost shifting. They're picking up care for all those poor people in the emergency room, the uninsured. So prices are being tuned up to try and capture what the hospital needs to recover in the way of revenue. It is a murky abyss. We don't know how we get to these prices. They don't make any sense. They're set not by true cost, but to recover revenue. This board, let us fervently pray, will take a look at pricing for the first time and say, how did you establish this price for this particular thing, and is it reasonable?
One of the things that Obama seems to be making a priority in terms of health care is computerizing medical records. Mm. And he sees this as, in the long run, a way of saving a lot of money and also just making doctors' work easier. What will computerizing medical records consist of, and what would it accomplish?
Well, I think people hear about computerized medical records and they think, are they going to be peering over my shoulder? Will I have any privacy? Right now, too much of our healthcare system depends on information systems that Charles Dickens would have been comfortable with. I mean, it's paper charts and people writing in bad penmanship, give Terry X amount of Y. There are people dying in America because of penmanship errors. I mean, it's beyond me that we haven't made that system electronic. So to make it concrete, your doctor should have a little BlackBerry or a little handheld computer device. It should have your medical information on it. It should be printed so that everybody can see it. And it shouldn't matter when the night shift comes on or the weekend shift comes on. They get the same information. Also shouldn't matter if we move you from the nursing home to the hospital, got the records. Shouldn't matter if we move you from the ER into the hospital and so on. The system we have now, if I go in the hospital and I say I want to see the chart on X, it may be there, it may not be there, some may have taken it out. And the other advantage of the electronic healthcare system is it will standardize data so that you'll have it in the same format. That should help reduce billing costs. It should help do audits on the quality of care because it's all in the same way.
Art Kaplan will be back in the second half of the show. He directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also chairs the Department of Medical Ethics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what's gone wrong with our public health system? We continue our conversation with bioethicist Art Kaplan about the tough healthcare choices facing President-elect Obama. And we'll talk about new ethical questions raised by the first face transplant performed in America. Also, our book critic Maureen Corrigan chooses the best books of the year. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about some of the tough healthcare-related decisions facing President-elect Barack Obama. My guest is Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics and chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Last month, Discover magazine named Kaplan one of the 10 most influential people in science. Now, let's take a look at the public health system. You've described it, in colorful terms, as a wheezing, uncoordinated, underfunded eyesore that needs to be rebuilt to face the challenges that 21st century living pose to health, ranging from asthma to diabetes to the flu.
Other than that, it's in pretty good shape.
Yeah, really. What's wrong with the public health system?
You know, it's been allowed to collapse. States, basically, counties support it. It's what we talk about when we think about who is it that's going to keep an eye out for pandemic flu, who's going to make sure that our water is clean, who's going to make sure that if we have an outbreak of salmonella in our food, who's going to jump on this is usually the public health department. Underfunded, completely low priority. Public health deals oftentimes with prevention. Politicians deal with crises.
Right.
Public health loses that battle every single time. Public health has traditionally taken a backseat in prestige to therapy. It's great to do a heart transplant. It might be nice if we could put in an exercise program or bring back recess or do the things that public health likes to promote in terms of healthy lifestyle. So we've shut a lot of the clinics. We have fired a lot of the people that work in there, and this system really has to be rebuilt. It has to be rebuilt for a couple of reasons. Diseases in the 21st century don't know state boundaries. They don't know national boundaries because of air travel and train travel. What's going on in Africa can be in Europe tomorrow very quickly. You need to have people monitoring and watching to see where these disease threats come from. It's not going to do us much good to have better vaccines and better medicines if we don't know how to deploy them in a reasonable way in response to an emergency. It just goes on and on in terms of setting out planning and preparation to deal with big health challenges.
Has the public health system been affected by the Bush administration? Has it been either bolstered or weakened in the 8 years of Bush?
I think the 8 years of Bush did about as much as could be done to basically annihilate the public health system. I don't remember anybody in the federal government talking much about it. I don't remember any budgeting going toward it. I remember budgeting moving away. And when you return some of the control to the states, which tended to be what the Bush administration did, the poorer states basically said, we can't afford this, so we're just going to cut it out.
You didn't mention terrorism, but that can be a public health issue too.
Terrorism absolutely is a public health issue. In fact, you know, Terry, there's a funny way to turn around something about rights and entitlements in universal health care. One of the things I've been thinking about as a moral argument is, you know, we built the Veterans Administration system. We have a health care system. Abraham Lincoln started it after the Civil War, so we have to do what we can for those who fought and sacrificed for the nation. And since then, we've had a notion that veterans are entitled. If they get injured in a war or war-related activities, then we should care for them. The age of terrorism, we're all combatants. Anybody could be subject to an attack or some terroristic event in Los Angeles or Minneapolis or Philadelphia.
You mentioned the history of the Veterans Administration and medicine for vets, mm-hmm. a system started by Lincoln after the Civil War. Many veterans have been complaining about the quality of care at the VA hospitals
yes.
in our country. And I guess I'm wondering from what you know, what needs to be fixed?
Some of what the veterans complain about is the lack of benefits coverage, which isn't health care access. It's getting their disability payments. There's a huge backlog there, and they're upset about that. Some veterans are also upset that if their injuries and problems are not directly related to something they can prove happened in combat, they're not covered. So there is this eligibility battle. You may remember coming out of the first Gulf conflict when we had the big debates about Gulf War syndrome. Part of the fight there was prove to me that whatever your problems are is linked up to your service. You know, the Lincoln vision was you get covered if you served. And we're not going to do this so much by is that bad arm or mental health problem linked up to service related, combat related activity, or did it just kind of happen during the time you were in the service? I think we should lower some of these barriers and simply say, if you serve, you get coverage. Now, that's costly. It's going to raise the cost, but I think it's more in sync with what veterans expect. The other problem, and one that I am a little less sympathetic to, is some veterans complain and say, you know, I came back, I have traumatic brain injury. I suffered some exposure caused terrible damage. I came back, I have PTSD. I now live in rural Alabama, and I can't get traumatic brain injury help. The reason I'm not quite as sympathetic to that is you're not going to build those specialized facilities in every single county of the United States. If you want some of that care, you may have to decide you're going to move to a more centralized location where those facilities are. You can't put them on every street corner it's too expensive, it's not efficient, it isn't even good quality necessarily.
Now, President Bush put federal funding restrictions on stem cell, embryonic stem cell research.
Yes.
Barack Obama has said that he will reverse those funding restrictions. What do you expect to happen with embryonic stem cell research under President Obama?
Well, there's a little inside baseball here, too, that I think people haven't been aware of, because most people assume Bush came in and issued some executive order saying, don't do this, and Obama will come in and reverse whatever Bush ordered. I'm not sure Bush actually ever issued an executive order about anything in stem cells. He just made it known that he was opposed, and the NIH and other places said, all right, then if you have that opposition, you never ordered us not to do it, but we're not going to fund it unless it came from, unless the cells came from what he called the approved lines, the stem cell lines that existed before he made his opposition known. Obama, I think, will make it clear that he isn't opposed. And I think the NIH will set aside some money to permit embryonic stem cell research to go forward. Some states are already doing that. California, Wisconsin, Maryland, they're already saying we're going to fund it. So in a sense, it's just going to expand the possibility of funding to scientists in every state. They already have it in some states. The tricky part is there's congressional legislation, something called the Dickey Amendment, that does not allow for research on an embryo. And I'm not sure that people realize that that may need to be revisited if we're going to talk about embryonic stem cell research. It basically says you can't experiment on embryos. The idea was don't do things to embryos that might somehow come to fruition as people, or don't just take them out and grow them and do strange experiments on them. In stem cell research, no one's growing anything. You're going to take the embryo, probably one from a fertility clinic that was left behind, and destroy it to get the stem cell out. But this notion of not experimenting on the embryo is in Congress.
And that's already passed?
It's already passed. And I think it's going to have to be looked at in a serious way if we're going to see stem cell research really expand, because some opponents are likely to invoke it and say that stem cell research violates that congressional mandate. It was done for a different reason, but opponents know that they could, if you will, slide it over towards stem cell research. So I think that's where the battle is going to be. I think Obama will say, here's the money, and then opponents are going to say, oh, yeah, well, what about this congressional law or restriction? How are you going to get around that?
When did that pass Congress?
That's been around, believe it or not, it's at least 5 years old.
I think it's fair to say not many people know about
it. Yeah, so it's out there. And there, I should add, there are also states that have passed laws, and some have been on the books for a long time, restricting research on embryos. Pennsylvania's one, Louisiana's one, South Dakota's one. Even if Obama said tomorrow, here's money, it's not clear in those states that critics or opponents wouldn't say, you know, you can't do that kind of research here, even though there's no opposition from the president because there's restrictions on what you can do to an embryo.
We've talked about a bunch of issues that President-elect Obama faces. Name a couple of others that you think are important that haven't been getting a lot of attention.
You know, lost in the sort of amazement of electing an African-American president and the cultural impact of that on America, some other things did happen in the last election that I think are hugely significant. Washington State joined Oregon in legalizing physician-assisted suicide. And within a few days, state of Montana had a court opinion doing the same thing. A judge said, this is going to be legal. Now, I'm trying to make a list in my head of political issues that no politician would ever go near, not just a third rail, but kind of a mountainous third rail that would be avoided at all costs. Physician-assisted suicide is probably there. But it is starting to get some traction in the United States. The experience in the state of Oregon has not led to abuse of physician-assisted suicide. In fact, it's relatively underused. People who are terminally ill ask for these medicines, but turn out not to use them. I think 50 people a year have ended their lives, which is tiny, in the state. But most people find it assuring that they can have the pills to do it, but they don't do it. Are we going to see physician-assisted suicide in the next couple of years on more state ballots? Are we going to see it moving forward, if you will? And I think the answer to that is yes. Initially, I was opposed to legalization. I thought, if you have a country that doesn't have health insurance for all, how are you going to start off by saying you have physician-assisted suicide for all, but sorry about that health care? Well, we're moving toward trying to do something about universal health care insurance, if not access, then at least getting insurance. That cements the environment, I think, for a little more trust within the system, that they're not going to send me off to oblivion because I can't pay. So I suspect we're going to see more states do this. I don't think it'll be a federal issue, but it'll be interesting to see if people in the administration, Daschle, Obama, have anything to say about this. Another issue is the battle over conscience. So a lot of healthcare workers who have issues with birth control or day-after pills and so forth, they want the right to opt out of the system and not have to be involved. And the Bush administration has been doing what it can to support them. I suspect an Obama administration is going to not oppose conscience, but at least not do things that make it easier for a pharmacist or a doctor to say, I'm not giving you those pills. So I think we'll see that issue toned down, if you will.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Art Kaplan, and he's the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's also a professor. We're talking about some of the medical ethics issues facing President-elect Obama. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Art Kaplan. He directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's also a professor. We've been talking about health care issues facing the incoming Obama administration and some of the tough choices they're going to have to make and that we're going to have to make as a nation. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something in the news right now that poses all kinds of interesting bioethical questions, and I'm talking about the face transplantation. Just sum up for us what the procedure was and why it was done.
Well, every once in a while, you get reminded why it's interesting, fun, and fascinating to do bioethics. And this face transplant is right there. People get, unfortunately, sometimes terribly burned and their face gets disfigured. Sometimes they're in traumatic accidents, cut, bruised, injured, face gets damaged. Sadly, people in war, both military and civilians, explosive devices go off and do terrible damage to their face. There are even a few people, sadly, who are born with congenital malformations, birth defects of their face that are just horrendous. So we're talking here about people with facial disfigurement that is so bad they may not want to go out. They would only go out wearing a mask. They're almost cut off from society because of the damage that their face has endured. Scientists and doctors have basically gotten to the point now where, learning from heart transplant and liver transplant, they think they can marry the use of drugs to keep organs from being rejected and the surgical techniques that they've learned to rewire muscles and nerves to allow you to transplant a face. It has now happened for the first time that people are transplanting a face in the United States. We had a partial face transplant take place in France. This face transplant now is a nearly full face. It came from a cadaver. So you have someone who is newly dead. Just as you would for a heart or liver transplant, you keep the person on life support. They're pronounced dead when their brain stops functioning. You then remove the face, literally, and put it on the face of the recipient who also has had their skin, muscle tissue removed. It's almost unknown yet whether you should take some of the facial bones and move them for a better outcome
or about that.
Just the muscles and the tissues. And we don't know the answer to that yet. It looks as if you move the bone, you're going to get a closer match to the face that the donor had. If you just take the tissues and the muscles and the material, it looks like it's not going to look quite the same when it gets on the new body. So we'll have to see how that sorts out.
Well, what are some of the ethical issues surrounding face transplants now that they're a medical possibility?
I started off in bioethics with transplants. It's what got me interested initially. And I have to say, the face transplant has oodles of tough, fascinating questions that each one of us in some ways has a stake in. For example, I said that the face transplant came from a cadaver. Well, many of us have signed a donor card, driver's license saying, yeah, I would be an organ donor. You can use my liver or my heart. I don't think many of us thought you would use my face. And the face is not the same as the heart or the liver. To put it bluntly, we don't identify one another. We don't have a psychological or emotional investment in our pancreas in the way that we do the face.
Yeah, we think of the face as our identity.
The face is us. The only organ I can think of that's more intimately tied to our identity is the brain. Second place, the face. So who you are, you fall in love with people because of the appearance of their face. You establish who they are because of their face. It's crucial in our culture to, in a sense, have a face that is presentable and so forth. And it's certainly the part of the body that gets looked at the most day after day after day. So there's certainly going to be some people out there who say, I don't think so. I don't want my face appearing on anybody else. There are going to be people who might even say, if that's a risk of carrying a donor card, then I'm not sure I'm going to do that. So we need to have a little public discussion very quickly about, do you require special permission if you're going to use something like a face? I give my consent to liver and kidney and heart, but there's an extra box here. I'm going to consent explicitly to the face. And I would favor that, but I think we need to decide whether we want to have that discussion as a matter of public policy. This would happen at the state level, not at the national level.
What are other ethical issues that a face transplant poses?
When you transplant a face, there's always a danger that it could be rejected. And we hear about this once in a while. Someone gets a liver transplant or heart transplant and the body rejects it. It's terrible. It's awful. It often can lead to having to go back on dialysis in the case of a rejected kidney. In the case of a rejected heart, it can lead to death. Having a face reject is a whole other dimension of suffering. Can't breathe. Can't eat. You're going to look bizarre at best. How are we going to manage failure? And I think that's one of the toughest ethical problems around face transplants. Would you say to the person who has it and is going through rejection, it's not working, the face is literally sloughing off, you don't have to accept any treatments, you can simply allow yourself to die? Would you go further and say, you know, that is so awful, so unbearable to even think about, we're going to give you something that accelerates your death? Those are some pretty tough questions, but I think they have to get answered before you could really let somebody undertake this. I hope they got answered in the face transplant that's underway, if you will, now. Major issue for face transplantation beyond managing a failure, what's the psychological and emotional impact on others who are intimately related to the people involved in the transplant? So do the family and friends of the donor, do they accept that this person has this face and they're able to deal with that and are happy about it? Do they feel some need to intrude into the recipient's life because they say, you know, you remind me of my sister, or that still appears to be my dad? And that's not literally true, but I think emotionally and psychologically, people often are grasping for ways to redeem a death and maybe even say, you know, you're still here. You're still going on in another person's body. And I think the recipient may be saying, I didn't sign up for a new family. I just wanted a new face. I didn't want all of you around. I do think you may need to provide counseling, support, help over time to both the donor family and the recipient family as they try to adjust to this brave new world of transplant.
Art Kaplan, thank you so much for talking
with
us. Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also chairs the Department of Medical Ethics. Coming up, the best books of 2008 as chosen by our book critic Maureen Corrigan. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has made her list of the best books she's read in 2008.
If I had to pick the Michael Phelps of fiction for this year, the gold would go to Joseph O'Neill's novel, Netherland, a story about post-9/11 New York City as viewed through the scrim of F. Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece, The Great Gatsby. Gatsby here is reincarnated in a Trinidadian cricket player, but O'Neill's novel is so much more than just an exercise in imitative gestures. Like Fitzgerald, O'Neill is a connoisseur of the lost dusty places in New York, and also a poet of retrospection, a mood that suits the city directly after 9/11. Remember how Nick Carraway, at the end of The Great Gatsby, talks about how when the green breast of the New World, Manhattan, first appeared before Dutch sailors' eyes, it was the last time in history when man beheld an object commensurate with his capacity to wonder? It's all over, Carraway is saying in that ending. The age of discovery, the roaring 20s promise of New York City. It's finished, kaput. We live in a permanent state of aftermath, which is where O'Neill's gorgeous, mournful novel begins. Two short story collections also top my list. Jhumpa Lahiri's Unaccustomed Earth zeroes in on characters whose natural tendency toward isolation is intensified by the immigrant experience. Most are first or second generation Indian Americans. As a writer, Lahiri is made of exquisitely stern stuff. And even though as a reader, you quickly catch on to the fact that her characters won't be granted reprieve from their loneliness, you stick with them for the great pleasure of their solitary company. The five electrifying stories in Uwam Akpan's debut collection, Say You're One of Them, are narrated through the distinct voices of children in Africa who've seen too much. They've lost family members to prostitution, AIDS, slavery, and genocide. Akpan's brilliance resides in the bewildered but resolutely chipper voices of these rough children, never overly endearing nor innocent. Let's lighten the tone here a bit. Muriel Barbery's wry and erudite novel, The Elegance of the Hedgehog, won the 2007 French Booksellers Prize. It was translated into English and published in paperback in this country this year. Barbery's tale of a middle-aged French concierge named Renée, who hides her hard-won education in the humanities from her building's wealthy tenants, astutely comments on class, presumption, and power. As Renée says, "As always, I am saved by the inability of living creatures to believe anything that might cause the walls of their little mental assumptions to crumble." Philip Roth's Indignation may not be what one would call a comic novel, given that it's set in 1951 and that our narrator, a 19-year-old Jewish transplant from Newark, finds himself shipwrecked on the antiseptic, anti-Semitic campus of a Midwestern college. But Roth's vision is always alert to the absurd. Indignation is Roth's bow to Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, a play whose brutally humorous tone is explicitly carried forward throughout this tale. Politics and history dominated nonfiction this election year, so I want to give a quick nod here to literary nonfiction. Elizabeth McCracken's memoir, called An Exact Replica of a Figment of My Imagination, is an intense and tough-minded meditation on loss. In this case, the loss of her first child, who was stillborn. McCracken captures the confusion of being thrust into a nightmare that hasn't been quite categorized. Brenda Wineapple's superb biography of the friendship between Emily Dickinson and her editor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, complicates our understanding of the Belle of Amherst and gives her more juice. Finally, the Library of America did readers a great service this year by reprinting A.J. Liebling's World War II writings. As this collection, which runs over 1,000 pages, demonstrates when the journalism gods made Liebling, they pretty much broke the mold. His style was forged by a classical education and the Great Depression and a vigorous print culture and fairy dust. And to any skeptics out there who think I'm being unduly sentimental, allow me to quote Liebling from one of the essays here in which he's defending his own sentimental impulses. "Cynicism," wrote Liebling, "is often the shamefaced product of inexperience." Not bad words to hold in our hearts as we look toward this coming year.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can read excerpts from the books on Maureen's year-end list on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find her list of the top 5 mystery novels of 2008. And of course, you can also download podcasts of our show on our website. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a new take on traditional Hanukkah songs and some new Hanukkah songs. We talk with composer Aaron Baron Cohen about his new CD, Songs in the Key of Hanukkah. We'll also talk about collaborating with his brother Sacha Baron Cohen and writing music for his movie Borat. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. We like to commemorate them bygone days, and we spin it to remember.